Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Rhys Ehrlich, who's a veteran correspondent who just returned from Iran, where he was covering the elections. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and his most recent book, Conversations with Terrorists, Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. Welcome to Background Briefing, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thank you so much. It's worth noting I was there on assignment for Global Post.
Oh, for Global Post. Well, tell me, though, the surprise outcome of Hassan Rouhani winning, and he, if you combine his total with the total of the other, at least the non-conservative on the ballot, the four conservatives handpicked by the Supreme Leader, I think it got about 18% total. The reformists arguably got 80% or 78%. So was the Supreme Leader caught by surprise, or did he have to have this kind of an outcome to maintain the credibility of the elections, which, of course, were pretty much shattered back in 2009?
Yeah, I'm not quite sure how you came up with those figures, but there's no question that the victory of Hassan Rouhani, the moderate, was a surprise to many folks, probably including the Supreme Leader. There's lots of conspiracy theorists in Iran who speculated that this was his plan all along or whatever. My reading of it and my interviews with ordinary people is that the one of the conservatives, Khalibaf, was probably in the lead right up to the last couple days. Lots of people phoned their friends and relatives and got people who were going to boycott, including many of the Green and reformist forces, and got them out to vote at the last minute. And that swung it in favor of Rouhani. And there was, you know, massive celebrating in the streets afterwards, despite the fact that that was illegal. So this is it's an electoral blow for the Supreme Leader, Khamenei. However, he still maintains the power on all key issues. It's a weak presidential system, and we can't expect too many changes, even though the moderate won.
Well, the figure I'd heard was if you combine the votes, the 52% that Rouhani got, and I believe it was the mayor of Tehran
he's a hardliner.
He
bragged about beating up students personally in 1999.
Right.
Yeah, the other candidates were all conservatives. That's what made it. Had it gone into a runoff, it's possible that the conservatives might have won if they had mobilized all of their forces and so on.
So there was nobody in between the conservatives and Rouhani could have come up.
One moderate and five conservatives.
Well, I shouldn't listen to NPR, should I?
So you care to listen. The question is, do you believe him?
Right. Well, I thought he was credible. So tell me then, on the question of legitimacy then, obviously the Supreme Leader wanted a conservative, and he wanted to maintain the posture of the resistance, if you will, is what they call it, you know, to justify the economic hardships, is that they're resisting the West. And clearly those that were disqualified, Rafsanjani, for example, in endorsing Rouhani, as Khatami did as well, obviously that was a signal then, was it, at the last minute for the people who were boycotting the elections to come out and vote?
Yeah, that's exactly right. To back up a few steps, in 2009, of course, there were charges of fraud in the elections, massive protests, millions of people marching in the streets, brutally repressed. And organizationally, the Green Movement was destroyed. But the sentiment that gave rise to it never was. But a lot of those folks, and you can make an analogy to American politics and why some folks don't vote when they feel they have no choice between Democrats and Republicans who carry out the same kind of policies. So the same debate goes on in Iran. And a lot of the Greens and reformers weren't going to vote because they didn't see a candidate that they liked. But the fact that Rouhani started to surge, two things happened. The genuine reformist, a guy named Aref, withdrew in favor of Rouhani because his campaign wasn't going so well. And the conservatives, who had made a deal to reunite around one candidate, reneged on the deal and fought it out amongst themselves. So in a real tactical victory, the moderate forces had one candidate and the conservatives split it among three. As a result, Rouhani came in with just over 50% of the vote.
So the Supreme Leader then, his mistake was he thought that even though he had split the Conservative ticket, he thought at least one of them would get enough votes for runoff, right?
Yeah, I think that was his thinking. And remember, all of the candidates were approved by the Guardian Council, which is a group of clerics, unelected, who determine who can run and who can't. And they thought they had narrowed the field in a way that would be favorable to the Supreme Leader. But that's the thing about Iranian politics. It's a real dogfight. These folks, all of whom are within the system, all of whom support the Supreme Leader, hate each other's guts, stab each other in the back, bring each other into court. I mean, it's a real fistfight. And we saw that played out, particularly in the last week of the elections.
Again, I'm speaking with Reece Ehrlich, who's a veteran foreign correspondent who just returned from Iran, where he was covering the elections for Global Post. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. So in terms of Rouhani being welcomed in the West, and his statements, I thought, were interesting, obviously a dig at his predecessor, Ahmadinejad, in saying that he's a moderate and he's not going to spread extremism and ill temper. I think that's what he was saying that he was against. But how much of a moderate is he? I mean, a lot of people in the West are citing the fact that when he was working for the reformist Ayatollah Khatami, who, after all, wasn't particularly effective, he was his nuclear negotiator, and he managed to negotiate a halt on nuclear enrichment, which was welcomed particularly by the Europeans. But then later in an interview in Iran, he said that it was all tactical, that he really split the Americans from the Europeans. And by the way, we needed a break to get all of our centrifuges cascades lined up. So it really didn't slow the program down at all. So what are we to make?
I've been studying his press conference and more recent statements since the elections. And he wants to strike a more friendly tone with the U.S., but wants the U.S. to change its position. He made it clear that it's no longer appropriate for Iran to suspend its enrichment, and he wants to see the sanctions lifted, but believes that Iran is not at fault. And I think a lot of folks in the United States would agree with that, in the sense that the U.S. has cranked up sanctions, fully knowing that Iran has no nuclear weapons program, and let alone a nuclear bomb, let alone being capable of attacking another country. So the Iranians puzzle over the fact that they're subject to the worst sanctions in their history, and they don't even have a nuclear bomb or have any plans to make one. So as far as the Iranians are concerned, it's another weapons of mass destruction in Iraq argument, which is that we have to be very, very afraid of these guys because they might do something evil in the future. Now, that's not to excuse the repression and the internal dictatorial policies of the government and the fact that people in Iran don't like the system that they're living under. But that's separate from making stuff up to turn them into an international threat as far as the U.S. is concerned.
But regardless of the U.S.'s hard line against Iran, which in many ways is, I think, driven by Israel, at least in the Congress, and that in turn puts pressure on Obama, the P5 plus one are also weighing in on sanctions as well. So it's not just the United States that's isolating.
No, that's true. Under pressure both from Israel and from the United States, a number of European countries have indeed cranked up the sanctions. They've gone along with the banking restrictions, which make it extremely difficult for Iran to do normal trade because they can't transfer money through the banking system. So, yes, it's not only a U.S. effort as it was for many years. But if the U.S. wasn't putting the pressure on, I don't think the Europeans would be implementing these harsh sanctions.
Well, the extent to which the U.S. is putting pressure on is pretty unprecedented. It is a form of economic warfare that the U.S. is waging because they are leaning on third parties not to buy Iranian oil. Now, they have obviously...
Not only that, it affects medical devices and pharmaceuticals and food. Mm. The U.S. likes to pretend that the sanctions are humanitarian and it's only aimed at the leaders of Iran. But I interviewed lots of people at hospitals, pharmacies, doctors' offices, and so on, who can't get really critical drugs that they need for multiple sclerosis or for chemotherapy. They're simply not available, or they're only available on the black market at three times the normal rate. And that's a direct result of U.S. sanctions, despite what the Obama administration claims.
Well, I was going to say that they're pretty severe, and then obviously the Chinese are ignoring them, and I believe Iran's oil is being sold through Iraq in any case. But still, I believe their revenues have been cut in half, which is for a government is pretty massive, and they are feeling the pinch, and I take it that a lot of the Iranian public just want this agony to end. And if you ask yourself, if they don't have a bomb, yet they don't want to open up their nuclear program, why are they putting themselves through this incredible pain?
Well, there's a nationalist feeling that it's true. People don't hate the sanctions, but they blame the U.S., not the Iranian government, for the problems, even with all the very real problems that exist there. Inflation, for example, predates the sanctions. I've been reporting on that for years. I had an interesting comment from one professor. He said, because I asked him, why this emphasis on nuclear power? It's not safe. What do you do with the leftover material after the processing? What about the huge cost of nuclear power compared to other kinds of power? And he said was, now that the U.S. has turned it into this issue, there's no debate in Iran about safety or economic issues with nuclear power. It's a matter of national pride. Ironically, if the U.S. wasn't pushing this issue as hard as it is, there might be more debate in Iran as to whether nuclear power makes any sense at all for them.
So, again, I'm talking with Reese Ehrlich, who's just returned from Iran, where he was covering the elections for the Global Post. And let me ask you then about the repression that you mentioned. And there was a very disturbing article recently in the New York Times from a head of a bus driver's union who was brutalized and his relatives were tortured, etc. And that's fairly routine. And these are the working class guys, you know, the very people that Ahmadinejad, running as a conservative populist, was trying to appeal to. And you wonder what the purpose of the state apparatus is in terms of repression against working class people as well as against the moderates in the Green Movement. And how can this new leader, since he's not the supreme leader and has limited power, and most his portfolio is mostly the economy, how can he change this police system? Because my understanding is, throughout the world, except for, say, South Africa, with Truth and Reconciliation, the minute you try to go after the secret police and the torturers, they fight back.
Yes, that's a serious problem, and the president basically has no control over them. Small example, we, as reporters, were given permission to go out to polling places to interview people, and we had official documents from the Ministry of Culture and Guidance and so on, official press passes, and then we get to some of the polling places, and the security services simply decided that we needed an additional permission from some other agency and wouldn't allow us in. Well, that's on a very small scale an example of how things operate in Iran, and it's ironic for the small number of people on the left in the U.S. who think that Iran is a victim of U.S. imperialism and some kind of a progressive regime. They brutally repress their union movement and any kind of Marxist or progressive or socialist thinking is brutally repressed in Iran. And the op-ed that you refer to, I had been following Mr. Öcalan's case for many years, going back to the early 2000s. So the president basically doesn't control the police, the Revolutionary Guard, and the army. Those are under the control of the supreme leader. And when reformist President Khatami was in power, there were brutal crackdowns on students at the University of Tehran, for example, he was powerless to do anything about. They simply go ahead and do what they want.
But Khatami was a librarian, and I don't mean to impugn librarians, but...
Watch out, you're liable to get some angry emails.
Well, I get them all the time, no matter what I say. But the point I was trying to make is that this new guy, Rouhani, is an insider, he's a negotiator, he's been involved in this revolutionary government for a long time, and he seems to have been able to navigate between these factions and survive and get approved by the Guardians Council to get on the ballot in the first place. And obviously a lot of people are investing hope in him, particularly on the Green side and on the reformist side. So he's a different kettle of fish from Khatami, who
Well, remember, Khatami had been the Minister of Culture. He had experience inside the government before he came to power, and he was also approved by the Guardian Council. Everybody is who ends up getting elected. So, if anything, Rouhani is probably more moderate than Khatami was.
But what about effective? That's the point I'm making.
We'll see. That's the answer. I don't think the problem is because Iran has a weak presidential system. You could argue that Ahmadinejad was effective in the sense that he tried to use the bully pulpit of the presidency to put more power in his hands, and he got slapped down numerous times by the supreme leader. And at this point, he's being hauled into court on criminal charges. He has to show up sometime in the next few weeks, and he's barely out of office. So the supreme leader has the power, and you can have a president who has more or less skills as a negotiator, but ultimately it doesn't really matter.
Well, I think it's commonly believed that Khatami, of course, was undercut by the West because we rejected the olive branches that he put out, and that essentially castrated him at home. And I think that's pretty clear, isn't it?
Yeah, I did both. That is, he was undercut by the West. The Khatami, this was in 2003, around the time of the beginning of the Iraq War, sent a formal letter to the Bush administration offering to negotiate on all the key questions that the U.S. had been raising for years, nuclear enrichment and support for groups like Hamas and Hezbollah and all kinds of issues that had been festering between the two countries. And the Bush administration not only ignored it, they tried to deny that the letter was ever sent, until somebody dug up a copy and proved and said that they had seen it come off the fax machine and at the State Department. So, yes, Khatami was definitely undercut by the refusal of the Bush administration.
Right. Well, it's hard to say it was the Bush administration since Dick Cheney was running the damn show. And he gave it the back of his hand and said, "We don't talk to evil." That's what Larry Wilkerson told me.
Yes, that's absolutely true. But at the same time, he was undercut by the supreme leader in Iran. In 1999, students were having some protests, and they ordered out these thugs called Basiji, and led by police and Revolutionary Guard, and they just went in and started beating up and killing students in their dormitory rooms. That was during the time of Khatami. He certainly didn't support it, but that was 99, so that was even before the conflict with the Cheney administration, if you want to call it that.
So
that was a brutal repression, and he was powerless to do anything about it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here today, Rhys Ehrlich.
Thank you.
Again, I've been speaking with Rhys Ehrlich, who's a veteran foreign correspondent who just returned from Iran, where he was covering the elections for Global Post. His books include Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis, and most recently, Conversations with Terrorist Middle East Leaders on Politics, Violence, and Empire. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the spy who tried to stop a war, Catherine Gunn, and spying on the G20 summit.
ای فدای آن همه عطر و بوی تو هر زمان دل می کشد پر به سوی تو هر کجا پا می نهم سر فرود آرم قبله گاه من شده خاک کوی